You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello from Studio One here in London and welcome to Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, from war planning and weaponry in the Middle East to the snowy expanses of Sochi, we'll review the day's top stories with Daniela Peled of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and Jeffrey Kaufman, ABC News correspondent. Then we'll explore the world of art market nationalism after an auction of Joan Miró's works is cancelled due to legal wranglings in Portugal.
85 works all in one go. I mean, to be honest, they weren't really pulled back for the reasons that perhaps Portugal's opposing parties would have liked. Everyone was objecting to the fact that these were officially state-owned.
Plus, in our daily review, and I'm looking forward to this, we'll give our verdict on a somewhat unlikely operatic production in Madrid.
Can I talk to Jack? I need to talk to Jack, please.
Ah, oh, see if you can guess what that's all about. All that and more coming up this hour on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to then in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. Before we begin, let's hear from Paul Osborne with the latest international news.
A scathing UN report has accused the Vatican of systematically turning a blind eye to decades of sexual abuse of children by priests. It demands known or suspected offenders be immediately turned over to face justice. The report says the Catholic Church imposed a code of silence on clerics, moving abusers to new parishes to try to cover up their crimes. The Vatican is promising to review the report, but is also claiming it's distorted and unfair. Maureen Sullivan campaigns for people in Ireland who allege they were abused while in the care of the church.
Disappointed that they're still living in denial and that they feel they've got the right to do that. But then when you think about it, how can they be honest about the horrific way that they treated people and having children as slaves?
Nine South African miners remain trapped underground after a fire and collapse in a mine west of Johannesburg. Eight others were rescued from the gold mine after the fire started 1,700 feet below ground. It's thought to have started after seismic activity nearby. Syria has missed the deadline to hand over all its chemical weapons for destruction. It's the second significant deadline missed since a deal was struck with world powers last year. It's claimed just 5% of Syria's stockpile of toxic agents has been handed over so far. The British Prime Minister David Cameron says it's not good enough.
What was a very promising start, with chemicals not only being discovered and removed but also destroyed, there do seem to be now indications that the programme is slowing and that not all the information necessary is forthcoming. I discussed this issue in a telephone call with President Putin some 48 hours ago. Britain will continue to put pressure on all parties to make sure the chemical weapons are produced and destroyed.
Work to extend the Panama Canal has been halted after talks on the spiralling cost of the project collapsed. The Panama Canal Authority is in dispute with the Spanish-led consortium behind the project over who should be responsible for costs running more than $1.5 billion over budget. The consortium claims 10,000 jobs are at risk, but the operators of one of the world's busiest shipping routes have said they will not be blackmailed. At least 34 people have been killed in a wave of bombings in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Dozens more were injured in explosions close to the high-security Green Zone, which is home to a number of Western embassies. Iraqi authorities say that more than 1,000 people were killed in violence across the country in January. Gay rights protests are being staged in cities around the world 2 days before the opening of the Winter Olympics in Sochi. Organisers want major sponsors at the Games to speak out about Russia's controversial laws on homosexuality. The demonstrations come as the Olympic flame arrives in Sochi ahead of the opening ceremony on Friday. One of America's biggest retailers is to halt the sale of all tobacco products. CVS Caremark will remove cigarettes and cigars from all of its 7,500 stores from the beginning of October. The decision will cost the company $2 billion a year in revenue. Executive Vice President Troy Brennan says it's the right thing to do.
We're part of the overall healthcare team. It's really antithetical as a result to have a product in our store, tobacco, which actually causes these kinds of diseases. So that's why it's so important for us to eliminate the sale of tobacco products today.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. There'll be more news from Paul Osborne around the bottom of the hour. He'll return with some world news headlines for you then. Right now, though, with the time at 5 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll be right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦. 这是 Monaco 24.
Orlando, du er Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on the news of the day are two Monocle 24 regulars and, can I say, favourites. It's Geoffrey Kaufman, London-based correspondent for ABC
News. Okay, we'll come back.
And Daniela Peled, editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both to the programme. Hopefully the first of many more appearances.
It was, by the way, a true test of our dedication getting here, because for those who do not live in London, we are enduring one of the London rituals that's called a tube strike. And so the streets are paralyzed in this one of the busiest cities on earth.
I think I set some kind of world record this morning, Geoffrey. 2 hours, 45 minutes it took me to get here.
Oh, my gosh.
I could have walked here quicker, and I may be doing that tomorrow.
I guess you'll be sleeping on the couch.
The possibly. Immense enjoyment of complaining about public transport in London, almost as good as complaining about the weather. And the combination, actually.
Two staples.
We could fill half an hour talking about the politics of this strike, but I know there are pressing issues for listeners around the world.
Before we even start talking about Bob Crowe sunning himself on a beach in Rio, let's not go there. Yeah. Let's start instead in Libya. In the past 3 months, contractors have worked to compile and destroy Libya's chemical weapons reserves. The process now complete. The US has labelled it a success. Albeit a process whose end comes a decade after Gaddafi handed over his stockpile, supposedly, to the international community. Comparisons nevertheless being drawn between this and the high stakes and delays involved in the removal of Syria's chemical weapons arsenal. Should parallels be drawn between the two? Daniela, if I can start with you, is it helpful to make comparisons, do you think? Does the Libyan example provide a template, a how-to for the Syrian example, or is it unhelpful?
Well, I think they're both quite good examples of how dictators have managed to deflect international problems by saying, OK, you can have our chemical weapons. But the comparisons are, I mean, it's not really the same scale. We don't know exactly how large both stockpiles are, but figures that I've read have said that the Libyan arms were something like 25 tons of sulfur mustard, which becomes mustard gas, whereas assessments of Syria's mustard gas alone is hundreds of tons, as well as sarin and VX and so on. So the quantities and the complex situation aren't really comparable.
Do you think, though, Geoffrey, there's a case for saying you do really need to be rid of the regime to be effectively rid of the risks of the chemical weapons?
I see this news as an effort to a symbol of how little good news there is out of the region. I mean, the fact that Libya is free of chemical weapons, they have so many other problems. The chemical weapons, of course, I don't mean to diminish the severity of chemical weapons if they're actually used, but mainstream standard weapons, there's the proliferation of AK-47s. I mean, one of the enduring memories of my very extensive time in Libya was every man over the age of, and boy, really able to handle an AK-47 had one, and they've kept them. And that is why the country is ungovernable now. We have militias, mafias, mobs, whatever you want to call them, and there is no rule of law here. So yes, of course, it's you know, something, it's an accomplishment that Libya is chemical weapons free. I would say if Libya were weapons free, it would be a much bigger accomplishment, and we're not going to live to see that. So I'm not as impressed. It has taken 10 years. This was not a result of the revolution. This was Gaddafi's effort to re-enter some sort of mainstream from the margins. Obviously, he succeeded for a few years and then didn't. But this is a legacy of, not of the revolution, but of the Gaddafi regime.
When we look, Daniela, at the situation in Syria, and there's such brutality, such terrible violence, of which some of it is connected to, though there's often fingers pointed over who's actually introduced these chemical weapons into the fray. Do you think there's a risk of almost oversimplifying things from the West? Do we seem to sort of build up chemical weapons into something wholly different, whereas the problems, as Jeffrey says, are often far more simple and often far more fundamental, and that's where we should be directing our concerns.
Well, of course. I mean, the fact that Assad has agreed to give up his chemical weapons hasn't actually slowed the rate of killing any degree at all. I mean, he's managed to kill a lot more people using conventional weapons. But I think unconventional weapons still is a very, very symbolic value. And it was very, very important to take a stand against them. But again, you know, it's sort of given the regime a little bit of an edge now by agreeing to give these up last September. It's got the opponents on the back foot. I mean, I think as well the timescale, a 9-month timescale to get rid of such an immense stock of chemical weapons also seemed...
But I would say Assad doesn't need them now. He's winning. I mean, that's the harsh reality is that whatever rebel forces, which represent so many different disparate camps, they're just not accomplishing anything. We're in a kind of stalemate that we've talked about it before around this table. This is it's bumping along. The West doesn't really know who to support because, it's the devil you know or the devil you don't. And Assad's got to go, but gee, who's going to replace him? There isn't anyone with virtue on his or her side, really his side, in the rebel groups. And so, Assad can afford to give these things up.
Yeah, it was a tactical move by Assad, which hasn't done him any harm at all.
It gives him some good PR in the West and gets the West off his back a little bit.
As simple as that. Let's look at the flow of arms and the movement of arms in the region rather more broadly. We've talked before about the changing dynamics in the Middle East when it comes to hard power. Israel's long held the qualitative military edge, supposedly. But with the influx of weapons to Syria, as we've been discussing, from Iran, Russia, American hardware in Iraq as well as all the weaponry, of course, in the hands of big non-state actors, Hamas, Hezbollah. The arena is certainly as complex or more complex perhaps than ever before. Daniela, what do you make of it? Do you think there is a broader shift in sort of the traditional balances of military power, or is there still fundamentally, you know, the key actors who have their key supporters from without, and those are the only dynamics that really matter?
Well, I think that's still very important, although it has changed and it remains very fluid. But in recent decades, we've also seen the emergence of non-state actors who wield a political and strategic punch far above the number of actual missiles they have. Hamas doesn't pose any real existential threat to Israel, and yet by firing or allowing missiles to be fired from Gaza, they can have a huge impact on what's going on in the region. But currently, Israel maintains the edge over this by simple factor that it's the only country in the region with nuclear weapons, although it doesn't admit it. And that gives it a massive edge when it comes down to it. That hasn't changed.
Absolutely. I wondered, Jeffrey, though, do you think when the sort of, all of the boffins in Capitol Hill or in, you know, seats of government around the world, particularly in the Western world, look at this, does it trouble them, as Daniela mentioned in particular, the difficulty of kind of categorising and quantifying those non-state actors and how the threat they pose, it doesn't sit in a traditional, easy-to-define label? Is that difficult when they come to make their grand sort of military
decisions? I think you have to add a third category to this, which is failed state actors. And I think that you know, when you look at Iraq, when you look at Afghanistan, now you look at Syria, those three are enough for now. Libya, I would add to that as well. Mm. you know, what we're seeing is a new arms race in this region that's really the American military industrial complex is making a lot of money selling arms to a lot of these countries, as is the Russian military industrial complex. But, you know, one of the most interesting places is Iraq, where the U.S. sunk so many tens of billions and so many lives and gave up. And now, of course, the Iraqi government is desperately trying to hang on to some semblance of order in what is fundamentally a failed state. What's the U.S. response? We'll sell you some very powerful weapons. And that's what they're doing. And as the U.S. abandons Afghanistan, we're going to see the same thing. There's a very good piece in Foreign Policy magazine about this this month. And after I read it, I thought, boy, if I didn't mind having blood on my hands, I would be investing in stocks of these military companies, these weapons companies, because this is a real golden age for them.
But you decided to stick to journalism.
Yeah, that and maybe tobacco companies. I don't know.
We're all grateful for that. I just wanted to know, it is extraordinary, isn't it, when you think of that sort of dynamic? The irony almost never ceases to be lost on some of these protagonists, be they big exporters of weapons or the governments, for example, in the US, who sort of condone that those sales. Should they be more concerned? Should they be better at preventing that from happening? It seems so simplistic to allow all of this cutting-edge technology to go into these countries, which are still so unstable and likely to remain so for some time. Do you think that they are culpable on that? I mean, should the Americans be better at simply not allowing it to happen?
I just don't think that's possible. I mean, the arms industry is a nasty kind of industry. You can make money in it, unlike in journalism. But that's just the facts of it. And also, they're a very unlikely bedfellows as well. One of the new realities we're facing, all kinds of strange alliances. One's between Israel and Saudi Arabia, for instance. I've lost count of the number of Israeli officials who've described Saudi Arabia as one of the moderate Arab allies. That's not how it looks from the UK, and you'd be surprised that Israel would consider Saudi Arabia an ally. But right, they've got some very powerful common enemy.
Right, and they're right. Iran being the biggest one,
exactly.
I guess when you're Israel, you look for the friends you can find, and they certainly share that. I think the role of non-state actors, which you asked about earlier, is a serious one. Hezbollah and Hamas have more than 60,000 missiles and rockets, which is three times what they had less than a decade ago. And there are more and more of these really lethal weapons in so many disparate hands in the region, and it does lead to instability. Your question, though, about should the U.S. avoid it, I agree. I just don't think it's realistic. If they could avoid it, they would have solved Iraq and they would have solved Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And both are a mess, and I think both will be revisited in some form in our lifetimes, because they will sadly descend into chaos. I mean, hopefully the Afghan election will lead to something good, but we'll have to see about that.
We will indeed. Let's talk a little bit about that Afghan election, of course.
Beautiful segue. Very elegantly done.
It was very elegant.
That's
only a couple
artful.
Of months away, of course. Campaigning underway, 11 candidates. The third election, of course, since the fall of the Taliban, and the first transition of power, perhaps more significantly, from Hamid Karzai, who is sort of bound to step down this time. Daniel, obviously some of the key issues, unsurprising, you know, security, we know the threat of insurgency, poverty in the country. Are any of these prospective candidates in any sort of position to deliver any meaningful change on any of those critically important issues?
Well, I think it's very interesting if you look at the 11 candidates, the majority of whom are former warlords, who still wield a lot of power. And what's interesting as well, the relative moderates, people like one of the front runners, Ashraf Ghani, he has chosen another very prominent former warlord to be his running mate, the Uzbek strongman, I think possibly who defines the word strongman, Rashid Dostum, whose troops were accused of complicity in one of the most famous massacres of 2001 with the Taliban troops who were left to die in the desert in metal boxes. So I think it says something about the situation that Afghanistan is, that even the moderates, even a sort of anthropology professor like Dr. Ghani needs a strong man like Dostum to have as his running mate.
But does it get him anywhere, you know, at the polls? Because he's campaigned before, a handful of votes, 2-3% only for a candidate like Ashraf Ghani. Any sense that there might be, you know, a more enlightened electorate this time? Is he going to actually challenge? I mean, is it possible to really speculate as to who might actually achieve anything?
Yeah, there are no front runners right now. I mean, I think Afghans have become very adept in 35 years of pretty much constant war, of thinking what would be the best survival tactic for them. Who is going to best represent their interests? And that's also where we're assuming that it's not going to be a horribly corrupt election as well. I mean, the reports I've heard from the ground is that already all kinds of vote buying and vote rigging is going on. So I don't think I can summon up a great deal of optimism.
You know, it is the test of these fledgling democracies, not their first elections, but their first transition of power. And so this is really a fascinating moment. The election will be this spring, but assuming this is like the French system. And so with 11 candidates, somebody's got to hit 50%. If not, then the top two have a runoff. Officially, Karzai steps down in May. It may not be till the end of summer that we know actually who's going to succeed him. But what's interesting is to watch Karzai himself, his own brother, who was, I think, running a restaurant in the U.S. when Hamid Karzai was elected president, is now running for president. There doesn't seem to be a lot of love between the two brothers. So the presumption that Hamid's going to support his brother would be misplaced. In fact, Hamid Karzai is playing his cards remarkably close to his chest, probably because, as you've already mentioned, there is no clear front runner, and he's not going to leave Afghanistan. He's in fact renovating an old UN compound as we speak, and clearly wants to have some sort of role, if not in the front lines, but in the back rooms of this new government. And so he's clearly, let me take that back. It appears that he's waiting to see who emerges and wants to be a kind of kingmaker rather than simply fade off and move to the Riviera.
It'd certainly be intriguing, and the sort of political succession will be something I'm sure we're going to talk about more than once here on Monocle 24. We'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and my special guest today, Jeffrey Kaufman and Daniela Peled. We'll be talking about, amongst other things, Sochi and a little bit of 24-hour news next.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. 23 minutes past the hour. Still with me is Jeffrey Kaufman of ABC News and Daniela Peled from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Now with the Sochi Winter Olympic Games almost underway, let's look a little now at how the event is being covered. It intrigues me always, Jeffrey, when you see these events, of what the sheltered Western journalists make of their travails that they're tackling. Who knew they could be so sensitive about a lack of shower curtains, for example? But I wonder, with all of the fun in games, but forgive the pun that we have with that, is there a risk of glossing over some of the really grim stuff that we should perhaps be talking about in a week like this?
Well, you know, I think it's inevitable. I mean, this is a spectator sport, and it comes with the territory. And this is Russia showcasing its greatness, its return to a superpower status, and $51 billion later, which I think is something like 10 times what Vancouver spent. a number of the main hotels are not finished, and those that are seem to be lacking doorknobs, light bulbs, and more critical elements. And the media are arriving, the athletes are arriving, and thanks to social media, we get to see it all.
You get the pictures of the bathrooms tweeted.
Right, and people sort of aghast that, oh my gosh, in this part of the world, your toilet tissue does not actually go down the toilet. It goes into the bin next door. And those of us who've traveled are used to that, at least if you've traveled in the developing world. But I think it's fair to say a lot of people going to Sochi are encountering that little ritual for the first time. But that seems that's fairly benign compared to some of the very serious structural problems they have. And I think the jury's still out. I said this before. I think that the question that remains with these games is, will people be watching the action amongst the sportsmen, the participants, or will this be a games about Russia's inability to deliver, as well as the issue of human rights and gay rights, which is just simply not going to go away, despite the fact Mr. Putin would like it to.
Daniela, what do you make of that? It's interesting, isn't it? It's hard to avoid speculating somewhat. Will we be looking at the slopes and on the ice, or do you think we'll be naturally much more preoccupied with what we're seeing in the streets in terms of protest, or, you know, let's hope not, but potentially in terms of, you know, the actions of terrorists and this kind of thing? Do you have a fairly grim outlook? Where do you stand?
Well, I think, I mean, we're laughing about the images. The images of the twin toilets, which I think is possibly one of the symbols of the Sochi Olympics.
I like the drinking water that looks like urine, and forgive that image.
I've come across that in Russia as well. But, you know, that's very jolly, and it is a sport when the Olympics come up, especially, you know.
And it did happen in Vancouver, I remember, as a Canadian living overseas, I was quite sensitive to watching the bashing of Vancouver. But the moment the game started there, everything went well, and it became one of the most successful winter games ever. I don't know if that's going
to
happen.
And
this
I would
time.
Like to point out the London Olympics, obviously, were faultlessly executed.
And heavily criticized in the lead up, too.
But looked cheap at the price compared. And I should add, Jeff, in terms of what you said about the 51 billion, not just 10 times more than Vancouver, but more than all the previous Winter Olympics ever staged put together.
So it's astonishing. For that also, you expect a bit of glitz and glamour, right? And I think people are a bit disappointed. It hasn't started yet. And as I was saying, and we can laugh about these little hitches, I think the issue of gay rights has really overshadowed the Olympics, together with environmental issues, abuses of workers and corruption and so on. But I think also we'll be lucky, and I hope this happens, that we avoid seeing any kind of spectacular terror attacks during the Olympics. Because let's not forget, you know, Putin chose to have the Olympics here to sort of say, look, I've managed to get one over on the North Caucasus. You know, I'm in charge here now. He's not, really. You know, there's all kinds of options for things to go wrong, not necessarily within the secure perimeter of Sochi, but not very far away.
Do you think that is wishful thinking, do you think, Jeffrey? I mean, it's very difficult. We've talked a lot before about how one polices an event of this magnitude. Is there any way you can't guarantee, but even go halfway to doing that?
None of us want to see a terror attack. I mean, the other things are amusing and inconvenient, these hotel issues. And I don't think there's a lot of sympathy for people who are lucky enough to get to the games, though I'm not sure I mind missing these ones. The threat of terror attack is very real, and I would be worried about it. The other thing people are discovering as they arrive is that the old KGB is very much alive, and they will get into your computers and your smartphones. And in fact, everyone, all of the journalists, my colleagues who are going over, have been warned, do not take your laptop, do not take your iPhone with you, because they will get the addresses and the address books, and they will get all of your data. And this is real. And this, you don't have to get a court order in Russia to do this. This is part of state law. There is an insidious element to all of this. It was somewhat true in Beijing as well, but it's quite aggressive and unguarded here, and it just adds to the taint of these games as they start. We'll see whether they can shed that.
I mean, I think what's important to remember, these games were supposed to boost Russia's soft power, and it's part of a whole sequence of sporting events. I think the university games, swimming championships, supposed to bring back the sort of Soviet glory days of sportsmanship, and particularly appealing to the bare wrestling and bare-chested Putin, right? So Will it achieve that? I'm not so sure. But will it achieve something amongst its domestic constituency? I don't think Russians. I think Russians will be pretty proud of what's going on. And I'm not sure that it will have a very negative effect.
What's interesting, actually, is that one of the blogs that I was looking at about all of these issues facing the unfinished Olympics, so many of the comments, and I'm not sure where they're coming from, were critical of this article that chronicled all the kind of comical mishaps and sometimes fairly serious oversights, missing manhole covers in very densely trafficked areas are not just a joke. But but so many of the comments were, oh, you know, the arrogant Americans, you arrogant Westerners, you've never traveled, you know, get a life, see the world. I don't know whether that's part of the Olympic propaganda machinery fighting back, but it was interesting to see that was the response.
Well, I think the Olympics are for foreign consumption, but they're also very important for domestic consumption. I'm waving the flag for the London Olympics, but I think it does have a quite profound effect on countries internally as well.
It certainly can do. Just moving on, because we're running out of time somewhat, I wanted to touch very briefly on a final topic we mentioned, which was this criticism from a couple of senior BBC News executives, former, we should add, talking about the demise of 24-hour news, if not imminent, certainly fairly proximate. It's interesting, isn't it, to look at this area. A lot of talk about the struggles that linear traditional technologies have in keeping pace with the demands that people make. I mean, Jeffrey, it's not an easy topic to sum up briefly, but are we at the end of the 24-hour news cycle, or if we're not, should we be?
I think it's an easy topic to sum up because, you know, I on the side have been doing some teaching, and my students who are 20 do not watch these networks. They get, you know, when I ask them where they get their news, it's a surprise to people of our generation, but it's Facebook. That's where they find out about the world, either through following news organizations or someone posting an article. They don't watch CNN, BBC World, Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera America. And it really has, they've all been eclipsed very much by the internet, by high speed transmission. I entered journalism in the 80s just as this era of cable and satellite was beginning, and it was incredibly exciting. Suddenly the world was connected, and you didn't have to airship film as the correspondents in Vietnam and previous eras did. But now we've gone beyond that, and the fact is, with breaking news, we don't turn to CNN or Al Jazeera or BBC. We'll turn to the internet and see what's being tweeted, what's coming across. And these networks have a very, very low audience. The economic model worked briefly, but they're really struggling. And so, yeah, I think the era is coming to an end. Although, does that mean they'll be closing shop anytime soon? No. Hopefully they're smart enough to find a way to reinvent themselves.
Let's hope so. Daniela, what's your take on this?
I think this is very good news because this means that I'm young and I'm on trend, because I don't watch 24-hour news because I don't need to. I absolutely don't need to. I need to remain abreast of what's going on. But the news channels is not where I go for this at all. But I think there's also a danger in that we should be worried that anything affects the idea of well-resourced and well-financed and proper traditional journalism. Because as much as I'm a fan of citizen journalism, Twitter and social media and so on, I still am old-fashioned enough to believe that journalism has some great skill, needs resources, needs ethics, needs morals, and needs to be practiced properly.
It's true, but 24-hour news has created this fraud of the importance of live, the importance of breaking news.
It was a parody of itself 20 years ago already.
Exactly. And so, you know, we have our correspondent standing live on the scene on a balcony in Beirut, but that correspondent can never leave because he's got to be back in 15 minutes to do another update.
And he's got to be standing on a balcony in Beirut.
Right. And so, you know, in fact, he's actually not in Syria. And in fact, what he's saying could actually be said from here in London or in New York. But he's in Beirut and we're going live to Beirut. And I think that this is a game. And you're right about resources. But the resources, from my perspective as a field journalist, have been squandered for a long time in this kind of game of urgency and immediacy and presence that, in fact, doesn't deliver the content.
The end of an era. As pronounced by it's imminent. As pronounced by Jeffrey Kaufman and Daniela Peled, my two guests on Midori House today. Thank you both very much for joining us here on Midori House.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Es
Questo è Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monaco, vado a City Chat.
From London.
London. London, cara.
This is Monaco 24.
Plenty still ahead in the second half of today's Midori House. Before we get started on all that, though, let's catch up with the latest world news headlines. Here's Paul Osborne.
A UN report has accused the Vatican of systematically turning a blind eye to decades of sexual abuse of children by priests. It demands that known or suspected offenders should be immediately turned over to face justice. The Catholic Church has promised to review the report, but also claimed that it's distorted and unfair. Nine South African miners remain trapped underground after a fire and collapse in a mine west of Johannesburg. Eight others were rescued from the mine after a fire started below ground. Syria has missed the deadline to hand over all its chemical weapons for destruction. It's the second significant deadline to be missed since a deal was struck with world powers last year. It's claimed that just 5% of Syria's stockpile of toxic agents has so far been handed over. Work to extend the Panama Canal has been halted after talks on the spiralling cost of the project collapsed. The Panama Canal Authority has said it won't be blackmailed after the Spanish-led consortium said that up to 10,000 jobs are at risk in the dispute over who's responsible for a cost overrun of more than $1.5 billion. And one of America's biggest retailers is to halt all sales of tobacco products later this year. CVS Caremark says it will remove cigarettes and cigars from all of its 7,500 stores at the beginning of October, a move that will cost the company $2 billion a year in lost revenue. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Paul will be back with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the next hour. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. It's time next to check in with one of our correspondents around the world today. We're heading to Santiago, where our correspondent, Stephen Bodzin, is standing by with a selection of the week's top stories on his beat. Steve, welcome to the programme. Thanks for joining us, as always. We start by talking about incoming President Michelle Bachelet. It's not all been plain sailing though for her, has it? I gather she's encountered one or two problems of late.
Sure. Well, Michelle Bachelet was elected president at the end of last year. She comes into office on March 11th. But in the meantime, she picked her cabinet secretaries and her subsecretaries and the governors who will be in charge of each of the equivalent of states here in Chile. And unfortunately, it looks like she didn't do the greatest job vetting their backgrounds. Now looks like about five of them are facing really serious questions. One of them actually yesterday stepped down. She was the person who had been picked to be the subsecretary of education because she was closely linked to some for-profit high schools. Profit in public education here in Chile has been one of the most controversial issues and one of the ones that brought Michelle Bachelet into office, the opposition to for-profit education. So wasn't maybe the best idea to pick somebody who was closely supportive of for-profit education.
Absolutely. And tell me about the rest of the gang then, this bunch of merry men and women. I mean, who are there any other problems facing any of them?
Well, the most remarkable one was she picked a guy to be a minister who he actually was found guilty a couple of years ago of having groped a woman on the subway and paid a fine, but then later got the charges kind of dismissed through legal maneuvers based on his good prior behavior. But the actual event, I think, remains unquestioned. The facts of the case remain unquestioned, as far as I understand. So that seems like a pretty grave misstep. But yeah, the other ones, it's all a lot of situations where the agriculture subsecretary supposedly underpaid for a shipment of pears and apples, for example. Little things like that, but just the kinds of things that that don't necessarily make an incoming cabinet member look quite professional.
No, I can imagine that might be rather problematic for President Bachelet when she takes over. Let's talk, Stephen, next about another big issue that we discussed a little before here on Monocle 24 about borders and border disputes, Chile and Peru, of course, as well. We had this decision from The Hague fairly recently, but I gather that hasn't really had necessarily that much of a direct impact, but it may not be the end quite yet of border disputes and ocean access arguments, will it?
Sure, exactly. So, yeah, the short story there is that Chile and Peru for years were arguing over the exact maritime boundary. At the end of last month, the 27th, in The Hague, they sent down the decision, and basically it was a sort of a split decision, gave Peru a very small amount more sea for their years of trouble suing to increase access their sea holdings out in the Pacific Ocean. But basically Chile got the best parts of the sea left under its control. The next issue is that Bolivia, for many years, has complained that they lost their direct access to the Pacific in the War of the Pacific back in the 19th century. Chile basically took over all of Bolivia's seacoast, and Bolivia has resented that for a long time. Their current constitution actually requires them to pursue all possible means to recover sovereign access to the sea. So at this point, now that the Peru-Chile case is over, and Peru did get a little bit out of it, Bolivia is certainly going to be pursuing its claim, probably going to a case at The Hague as well.
We'll keep a close eye on that one, Stephen. We're also keeping a close eye this week on events in Sochi, the Winter Olympics, of course. I just wonder about how that plays in Chile. Is there much talk about who from Chile is actually going, and what does the sort of representative body look like? Is it an impressive phalanx of athletes, or is it rather more modest?
Yeah, modest is the word. This is actually the biggest Winter Olympic team that Chile has ever sent out. Only sent 3 people to Vancouver. This time it's sending 6 people, 6 team members. So that's, yeah, that's small. But it's a country with great ski runs. A lot of the world's best ski teams actually come to Chile in what is the northern summer, our winter, so that they can practice. But the problem is the winter here is shorter than it is in the northern hemisphere. It's here where we have the high enough mountains to have snow, it's relatively warm areas. So we have a pretty short ski season compared to somewhere like Colorado or Switzerland. And it's very expensive for the teams here to go to those places and practice all through your winter. So the Chilean Winter Olympics team really isn't all that impressive. What's the big deal here is that actually we have the South American Games coming up. In the next few weeks, they're starting, and that's actually attracting a lot more attention. Summer sports here and big mountain bike races, a lot of big events coming up in the South American Games.
So perhaps we should look for Chilean gold medalists at those games rather than on the slopes in Sochi, perhaps. Just finally, Stephen, let's talk a little bit about, a bit of culture, a bit of motion pictures. Tell me about a big movie. I'm sure many of our listeners will be well familiar with the story from a few years earlier about the miners, hapless miners who were trapped underground, of course. They're being immortalized on the silver screen. Tell us about this one.
That's right. So the 33 miners who were trapped underground for a couple months under the Atacama Desert back in 2010 is now being made into a movie. The casting is well underway, and the kind of top stars have been picked. They were actually here in Santiago at the end of last week, met with the president. The big star is Antonio Banderas. There's a lot of other people who are going to be in that movie. It's going to be kind of obviously the cast of 33, but really cast of thousands. They're doing a big big production. The movie is going to be called Los 33, and expect that out sometime in the next couple of years. The President Piñera, who made a big production out of rescuing the miners back in 2010, certainly has been continuing to milk it for all he can, and held this big celebration with the stars of the movie and also some of the miners who were rescued, and had them all visit him in the presidential palace, and kind of, even though he's now down to his last few weeks, once again trying to bring back the glory of 2010.
Absolutely. He's certainly determined to go out on a high note. Stephen Bodzin, thanks very much as always for joining us. That was Steve Bodzin, Monocle's man in Santiago. Plenty more still to come on today's edition of Midori House. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, the auction house Christie's has cancelled a sale of Joan Miró's art worth around £30 million after Portuguese lawmakers attempted to force an injunction restricting the sale. While the injunction itself was rejected, Christie's decided to pull the sale over uncertainty about the ownership of the pieces. The Miró collection was taken on by the Portuguese government when it nationalised the BPN Bank in 2008 in the height of the economic crisis. Melanie Gerlis, art market editor for the Art newspaper, told me how shifting this amount of paintings, no less than 85 in 2 days, would have been a tall order, even for Christie's.
85 of any one artist, even very prolific artists such as, you know, Picasso and Warhol, 85 over 2 days was always a fairly big ask for the market to swallow.
Melanie, tell me, when these things do appear, do we normally expect, you know, auction records because of the interest, because of the focus? Or is there almost a sort of negative corollary that, you know, when there's such a sort of sudden glut, it actually can detract from the individual appeal of individual works? How does it tend to work?
I think you probably get a little bit of both. I think you do get a flooding. It is likely that the market could have been flooded and there wouldn't be appetite for that number of mirrors. Having said that, maybe a handful of them, the most important ones or whichever ones, you know, were looked the nicest, maybe a handful would have attracted much more attention to themselves for being part of a sort of standalone collection and getting their own publicity and everything else that goes with that.
Absolutely. Now, Melanie, it's intriguing that we see these sorts of cases where paintings are blocked from appearing in auction houses. Sometimes it's due to a dispute over provenance or ownership. How common is it that things are undermined by fairly extraordinary circumstances where basically, I suppose, a nation state almost objects? How frequently do we see this sort of thing?
Well, I can't remember seeing it for this number before. I mean, you do get works that get, individual works that get sold. I think actually quite recently Jane Austen's ring got sold at auction and it went to I think a celebrity in America. But then the UK nation, the state said, no, we want to keep this. And if you can raise enough money here, then you can, you know, there are certain objects that are deemed important enough to pull back. But 85 works all in one go. I mean, to be honest, they weren't really pulled back for the reasons that perhaps Portugal's opposing parties would have liked. Everyone was objecting to the fact that these were officially state-owned and, you know, national treasures in a way. And that didn't seem to stop anybody selling. But because there was, and oh, there is an outstanding question on their title, so whether or not the seller is allowed to sell them, it had to be stopped. Presumably, if that gets resolved, these will all come back. But for Christie's, you know, to sell 85 paintings potentially to 85 individuals and then have 85 cases of works that had to be withdrawn was presumably not worth it.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that sort of side of things. I mean, how cautious do auction houses like Christie's have to be then with this sort of thing? Plainly, if something's already the subject of a dispute, people are going to be very guarded and rather cautious. But is it a sort of a workaday worry that is always there with any big sale, high profile sale?
I think with any object that an auction house sells, they do their homework in terms of making sure, yes, things like legal title are in place. Legally, an auction house doesn't absolutely 100% have to. That, you know, they act as an agent, so if someone is selling, they are the intermediary. But houses such as Christie's and Sotheby's have such a reputation to protect that they're not going to take the proverbial. But you would hope that they had checked. I'm sure they had checked. I'm sure they were as surprised. And you know, like I say, these opposition parties really have been looking and looking and looking for a way to block the sale, and they managed to find a technicality.
Melanie, I just wondered finally, in terms of the background to this more broadly, of course, Portugal had these assets supposedly as a result of the nationalisation of a bank which held this incredible stock of pieces. So I suppose we can sort of attribute it fairly directly to the sort of austerity measures we're seeing. Has that been an influence around the world in terms of art market changes? Have we seen a lot of works coming up from both countries with private national collections and indeed private collectors who have been sort of forced onto the market, if you like, their hands been forced by the difficulties that we've seen probably since 2008? Or have, generally speaking, a lot of the big collectors in these national collections been fairly sort of redoubtable in dealing with that pressure?
No, you're completely right. There have been more works coming to market. I mean, there are three things. Traditionally, there are three things that impact on the supply, on works being sold, and that's the three Ds, which is death, divorce, and debt. And debt has obviously been very much at the forefront since the 2008 crisis. We saw Lehman Bank sell some works, and a lot of banks have been traditionally art buyers. So those came to market a few years back. You've obviously got these from Portugal, and there have been dribs and drabs from other banks, a couple of Irish banks as well. And then you also get fewer buyers at that level. So there are probably fewer corporate buyers now, because if I was a bank trying to fight to pay my employees' salaries and bonuses, I'm not going to go around conspicuously buying art. Having said that, where there's a more desperate seller, then you're going to get lower prices and more buyers. And there are other buyers who are not getting great interest rates who think, well, we might as well buy art.
That's Melanie Gerlis from the art newspaper talking Miro with me a little earlier today. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. 9 minutes before the top of the hour, we are consequently fast approaching the end of the show. But as promised, it's time for our daily review segment. Today we're talking theatre. Brokeback Mountain has made the perhaps rather unlikely leap from international cinematic Oscar winner to the stage, but not to drama, but to opera. Madrid's Teatro Real is showing the production of the same name to great fanfare. Here, you lucky people, is a flavour of what you can expect.
Can I talk to Jack? I need to talk to Jack, please. And Estelle Mar, his fishing buddy, we're old friends. Please, put him on.
I'm sorry to tell you this, but Jack passed away in July.
Ennis and his ex-wife arguing in the kitchen, in case you were wondering. Well, our Liam Aldous is in Madrid and has seen the production and joins me now on the line with his verdict. Liam, before we start, let me ask you, are you an opera buff generally?
No, I'm not actually, but my grandfather is. So I have been brought up in a bit of an operatic household. I was surrounded by a little bit, so I know a little bit about opera, but I'm not an aficionado.
Okay, but you've got it in your genes, so you know what you're talking about. Tell me a little bit about this Brokeback Mountain then in Madrid. How did it measure up? Let's go through it kind of piece by piece. Obviously, you've got the script, you've got the production values, and you've got the talent, and you've also got the music. Did all of those different categories measure up in your view?
Well, not so much. Like you said, you listed through the main features. I have to say the script was very good. The talent was actually outstanding, and the production was amazing. And just the fact that it's at the Teatro Real, the Royal Theatre, is by its very nature quite controversial on paper. But then sitting down in my seat when the music started, unfortunately the main pillar of an opera, which you'd hope would be quite good, was the music wasn't actually that good. So for me, it just seemed a little bit monotonous and gloomy and just too brooding. And the composer actually claimed that he was trying to create a sense of peril throughout the whole opera, but it just translated into a very monotonous musical experience.
Oh dear, well you've got to be careful when you're handling peril with your operatic audience. Tell me, Liam, I'm interested in that point you raised there about the sort of reaction to the show being staged at the Royal Theatre and the sort of denizens of Madrid, what their response was. Did you talk to anyone? Did you get a sense of whether there was any feeling of surprise, or did perhaps people find that it really wasn't so much of a challenge? Or maybe Madrid, you know, is not that archly conservative anyway, so there wasn't any need to have expected such.
No, Madrid definitely isn't that conservative, particularly in relation to gay rights and the presence of gay people in entertainment and what have you. But the Royal Theatre's director, the ever polemicist Gerard Mortier, actually claimed before the first showing that he did actually expect it to ruffle a few feathers and perhaps raise the eyebrow of sections of the conservative Madrid public. But I didn't get a sense of that at all. The audience stayed in their seats. No one walked out. And people mentioned to me after, I did talk to a few people, and they said that this may have been controversial 15, 20 years ago, but really it's not controversial at all. And even the Crown Prince and the Crown Princess were there at the showing that I went to, and their very presence just seemed to illustrate the change in societal attitudes.
Well, you do mix in some pretty illustrious circles there, Liam. You mentioned that the music didn't quite measure up in your view. Let's give our listeners, maybe who haven't had the chance to see the show yet, another little extract. This is a bit when Ennis finds out, spoiler alert, that Jack is dead. Let's take a listen to this.
Sounds like that hawk is saying, free, you are free. Up here we are free.
Oh, well, it's pretty broody stuff, as you said, Liam. What did the other people you spoke to make of the music? Was there much of a muchness? Did people tend to sort of fall down into your school of thinking on this, that the music didn't quite measure up?
That is a lot of the chatter that I heard, and other people that I know that have seen that mentioned the same things. I think a lot of the time when you have a high-profile work like this, expectations are built up, and when the music doesn't really fulfill those expectations, that's when people get really disappointed. But the fact that they're doing Brokeback Mountain at the Royal Theatre is obviously one of Mortier's attempts to get younger audiences into the opera, and I did see a few younger audience members, but the overall median age was quite old, and it did feel like I was watching kind of like the Brokeback Mountain movie with a room full of my grandparents. It was a little bit awkward in the beginning, but in the end it was a bit of a nothing, really.
Absolutely. Well, let's have one last little extract. This is Ennis and Jack singing about, well, an experience, shall we say, they've just shared together.
You got burnt, had your way about everything. The divorce, I pay you child support, I stay out of your way, I hardly ever see the kid, so what do you need? You got burned.
Well, that's certainly contemporary opera right there, Liam. Tell me a little bit about Mortier then. He's obviously been a champion of that, as you mentioned. He's trying to draw younger people in. Do you think that will work? Because it certainly wins a lot of headlines, I guess. Or do you think ultimately the fact that maybe it didn't quite measure up musically, that in itself remains the key problem in terms of a barriers to keeping people from coming to watch the shows?
Yeah, it could definitely be a problem. His attempts, he was actually the director of the New York City Opera years ago, and he actually did manage to bring the median age down in New York, but he's actually quite gravely ill at the moment, and he's actually dying, and his appearance at the press conference is so noticeably gaunt, so this may actually be his swan song. A lot of the other critiques in the papers were saying that it might actually be quite unfortunate for him because it was built up so much and didn't really deliver. So he is a very controversial character. He likes to shake things up a bit, but unfortunately, I don't think it shook things up a bit as much as he wanted anyway in Madrid.
Perhaps not. But Liam Aldous, thank you as always for joining us with your insights. That was our Liam Aldous in Madrid talking about the Brokeback Mountain Opera, a show I'm definitely checking out next time I'm passing through. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to my special guests here in the studio, Jeffrey Kaufman and Daniela Peled. Today's show was produced by Ella John, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rosie Sells, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Up next, we've got the entrepreneurs. We'll be hearing from a Dutch designer in Maputo. We'll take a look at the Turkish startup scene, and we'll speak to the man who thinks business travelers should stay in a hostel on their next trip.
When we started Generator back in 2007 and really reshaped how hostels were perceived, we injected the same passion and the same inspiration from art and boutique hotels into the hostel space.
Stay tuned for that. This show returns at the same time. That's 1800 hours tomorrow. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.